beginning here on the bottom of Chof Amud Bet, 12 lines up. The Gemara says, Hamashchit Pa'at Zikano, which is what's mentioned in the Mishnah, one of the violations that you get Malkot for. Tarabanan Pa'at Zikano, Sof Zikano. That means the end of the beard. Vezu Sof Zikano, what is the end of the beard? Shibolet Zikano. That is the Shibolet. Now here, if you look in the Rivan, he says, Kulo Chamesh Peot, Kachoshi Bematnitin. It's talking about all five of them, Bichlal Shibolotim. They all are defined by Shibolet, and that really matches with the Shita of the Rivan, who we're going to see later today, says that the 5 points on the beard are all along the base of the jaw. And that is that he thinks that the 2 points of the Patz Zakan are here at the corner, one in the corner, then two right at the chin, and then the center, which is the middle of the chin. So he has all five of them in a row there, and he says that all of that is known as Shibolet HaZakan. Others define Shibolet HaZakan just as the tip or the edge over here where the chin is, and you'll see because they have other areas where you have, for instance, points that are much higher up than the Rivan. Rivan's points are all along the base of the jaw, so then you can call all of them Shibolet HaZakan, as opposed to Rashi in Shavuot. Or you have the Shita Tarach, where they have points that are higher up, near the joint between the jaw and the skull. Those points, you're not going to call them Shibolet Zakan. So in those cases, for Rashi, and for the Rabbeinu Kananel, Shibolet Zakan is just the middle point at the chin, but it's not the entirety of the five peyot. So just know that here you have the Shita Tarivan, who puts the Shibolet Zakano as being the entire 5 points, but most Mifarshim, most Mishonim, believe that that is the final point. The lowest point, which is over here at the chin, although there is a shita at the Ireim, which is brought by the Hagot Mamoniot, as well as by the Rosh, based on the Mishnah Negaim, which is that if most people believe that the fifth point is the chin or the center or the monton, you'll see those are the different words that are used by the Rishonim over here. The Ireim believes that it's the pika, which is the Adam's apple. That would lower it from the chin down, make the fifth point down here. It's much lower than the other Rishonim. For instance, the Rambam mentions that the mustache is not included in the Peot HaZakan because it is not inside of the 5 points of the Zakan, the Shita Tarambam. If you say also that the Monton of the Shibolet Zakan is this middle point, the chin, then anything below the chin area would also not be included in Peot HaZakan. But if you subscribe to the Ireim, if you're dealing with an Isur Doraita, normally it would be Choshesh for Shita like that, then you would have to also worry about anything that's below the chin as well, down till the Adam's apple. Something below that then wouldn't be subject to Peot HaZakan. Alright. Ve'amisareit Srita Achat. Someone who cuts a single cut. Tarabanan. Viseret. The psukim that we're speaking about here, there are two psukim that deal with this issue. There's one pasuk that's found in Dvarim, which is Banim Atem Lashem Elokeichem, Lo Titgodudu. Lotusimu karcha beninechem the mate. So that's one pasuk. The other pasuk is actually found in Parshat Doshim, which says, Seret na nefesh, lo nitnu bisarchem, tovet kaka, lo tinu bechem ani Hashem. We'll get to the tovet kaka a little later in the daf, but here on the seret na nefesh, lo tinu bisarchem. It says, Tarabanan, viseret, yochol afilo seret al beito, shenafal, vasfinato shetava biyam. You would think over anything that causes this person dismay, or difficulty, if he cuts himself because of that, you'd be in violation of the Din Doraita. Tamid lomar lanefesh. It says you have to do it over a loss of someone, meaning a death. Einu chayav el alamet bilvad. So it's associated particularly with death, and not just any cut that you make in yourself. Minayin lemisareit chamesh sritot amet echad shu chayav akol achat vechad. How do I know if a person cuts himself numerous times over the same niftar? How do I know he's chayav in each one? Tamanomar viseret. That means the chayav called srita visrita. Tell you that any srita, I mean it's written in the singular, any srita that you do will obligate you. So if you do multiple sritot, then you're going to be chayav on each seret, even though it's over the same death, over the same mate that you are doing this. Srita relates to the mate and the individual upon which the srita is done. So maybe there you would think it's one srita, because it's all about the same topic and the same person's doing it. The issur is to make a srita on yourself for the mate. You thought for that one mate, anything you do on you was amalgamated into a single violation. So the Rivan gives you two reasons why over here the din will be different. Either there's a riboy from the vav, Or the use of the singular form versus the plurality means that each one of them individually is a separate violation. Possibly we'd have to give a separate hatra'a for each violation, and by chalev it would be the same thing. You tell a person when he's eating multiple kazaitim of chalev, if you warn him each time, then he will get malkot for each kazayit that he eats. So then in that sense it won't be so different, but over here the reason that the Gemara is pointing it out is because generally we have a principle of what's called kufim mechulakim, that we want it to be a separate entity in order to get a chiyuv. Over here, the entity is the same. It's the same mate, and it's the same individual, and yet you're going to be chayav on each cut. We don't see this as being a continuous cut or all part of one thing. The Balei Tosafot and the Rivan yesterday had a machloket about whether when you give hatra'ah up front and then you violate something in a sequential basis afterwards, is hatra'ah only good for the first violation, which was the view of the Rivan. It only covered the first violation. After that, you're not going to be chayav unless you're warned in each one of them. The Balei Tosafot said that if it's toch kedei dibur, and if you do them sequentially one after the other, the first hatra'ah can cover all the violations that are afterwards. In this case, it's possible that you can give one hatra'ah, and then if he does it one after the next, the sritot, then he would be chayav for it. But the question is, how do you separate between the levin without ruining the hatra'ah? That's what Rashi and Tosafot were discussing about the beinasa, was when is it considered to be separate enough that it's a separate violation. But for instance, if you keep going and going and going, does that one violation or is that two separate violations? Because you have a shiur. Once you cross over the threshold of the shiur, does it make it a second violation? That's what they were dealing with in terms of the machlokot over here, is when is something separate. So a srita, Rabbi Yossi Omer, minan sreit srita achat al hei metim. How do you know what the story is when you do one srita on five different metim? Shu chayava kol achat ve'achat. He's going to be responsible because he did it for five different metim, will count the srita as not being one srita, will count it as being five separate violations because it's connected to five metim. Tamalomer le nefesh. Chayav akol nefesh ve nefesh. For every nefesh, you are chayav. Va'afikte le beitosh nafal usfinatosh etava biyam. Didn't you already use that to tell you that you're only chayav and sritot that relate to a mate, not to other difficulties or travails that you are facing? Because Rabbi Yossi, Srita Gdida Achati. Rabbi Yossi believes that Srita and Gdida are all one thing. Uchtivotam the mate. And over there it specifies specifically that it is the mate, because it says, Banim atem Hashem elkechem, lo tidgodudu, lo tasimu korcha ben enechem la mate. It says, since lo tidgodudu and the Easter against Meser the Nefesh lo tidnu bimsachem are the same violation, in one place already specifies you for mate. So I don't need the word nefesh over here by Sarah the nefesh to tell you about the fact that it's associated with a mate, because I have that by lo titko to do. Once I know that, then I can use the word nefesh over here to teach you that each nefesh, each goof, that's a separate mate, will now obligate you. So if you cut one cut over five mateim, you're going to be chayav for each of those mateim that are there. Amar Shma, amisareit v'kli chayav. Person who cuts with a kli is chayav. Most likely what he means over here when he says bikli chayav means af bikli. Also with a kli you are chayav. And that is what the Rivan explains over here, that when Rabbi Yossi says srita gdida achati, means tarvayu, means you're in violation whether you use a yad or whether you use a kli. Now everybody agrees that the ikar gdida is with a kli. Ikar srita mashma biyad. Rivan says everybody agrees that the primary violation of lotit gorudu is with a kli, and the primary violation of srita is with a yad. And what Shmuel is coming along to say is, amsaret v'kli chayav, that even if you do with a kli, you're still in violation of srita. And that is a person who makes a chabura in himself with the kli amate, chayav mishum shnei levin. You're going to be in violation of both of him, mishum saret, or mishum gedeit. It's both, and they're not synonymous to the point where we say it's only one violation. There are two violations here. Each violation has a primary meaning, but the secondary meaning is still considered here. And therefore, if you're misereit with a kli, that means that you're going to be in violation of lo tidgodudu, which is a given, because that's done with a kli. But you're also going to be in violation of misereit lenefesh, lo tidnu bimsarchem, because that's also speaking about a kli. And that is the view of Rabbi Yossi, but basically Shmuel is saying this in Rabbi Yossi's shita, even though it would be a diok out of Rabbi Yossi's shita. But Shmuel makes it explicit here in saying that, given what Rabbi Yossi said, now you're going to be in violation of two levin if you do this with a kli. Whereas for the Rambam, at least according to the Kesef Mishnah, it sounds like that if you warn the person for this lav, then he would be in violation of this law, whether he used the kli by seret or whether he used the yad by lotit godudu. And not necessarily that you'd be in violation of both for doing one action, like the Rivan suggested, but you would be chayav for each one of them, no matter which tool that you use. And of course, if you warned about both of them, then possibly, even according to the Rambam, you would be chayav for both of them. Meitave, srita v'gdida chati, elish srita v'yad v'gdida v'kli. The srita v'gdida are one, but srita is done by the yad, u'gdida v'kli. So here you see that there is a separation between them. So in terms of there being one, it means that they're both an injury to the individual. It doesn't tell you the mechanism of injury. It just tells you that they're the same thing, which is you're not allowed to injure yourself when someone passes away. How you injure yourself actually is differentiated between them. And gedidah would only be with a kli, and seret would be with your hands. So now that's a question on Shmuel's position, which is that he says, even if you're misareid b'kli, you are chayam. Who damar Rabbi Yossi? That's what we just said before. Shmuel is just an extension of Rabbi Yossi's opinion, who believes that srita and gedida, achati, literally achati, they're the same violation, not to the point where you're not chayab too, but to the point where it doesn't matter if it's done with a kli or a yad, you're going to be in violation of both of them. And again, it is a pol yotze of Rabbi Yossi's shita, just he never said that explicitly, so Shmuel codifies it and says it explicitly, that based on what Rabbi Yossi said, this would be the outcome, that if you cut yourself with a kli, you're going to be chayav for lotit godudu and for seret lenefesh lotit nubim sarchem. It teaches you both items. Lotit godudu teaches you about a kli, and seret teaches you about a yad. But they're not exclusive. That means that if you had given me a choice to say lotit godudu, I would have said it's a only kli. If you gave me seret, I would say you would only see yad. Now that I know both are a violation, Rabbi Yossi says that conflates the terms and says that you're going to be chayav on both of them for both items. But if you had only given me one, I would have only assumed one violation. Tani Tanaka made the Rabbi Yochanan, Amet, Ben Biyad, Ben Bikli, Chayav. Avodat Kochavim, Biyad, Chayav, Bikli, Pator. Tana was saying over the Brito, the Mishnayot, before Rabbi Yochanan. It says, for a mate, whether you use a Yad or a Kli to create the Chabura, the injury in the individual, you're Chayav. When it comes to Avodah Zarah, if you do it by hand, you're chayav. If you do it with a kli, patur. Va'ip chaktiv. Doesn't the pasuk in Melachim say just the opposite?
By the Nevi'ei Baal at Har Carmel with the showdown with Eliyahu.
Ve'id godudu kimishpatam b'charavot u'beramechim. They acted like you would have expected in this situation. Ve'id godudu. They did a gdida kimishpatam. The way that they normally practice. And how do they do that gdida? B'charavot. They did it with the swords and with the spears. It was using a kli in order to create the gedida. If that's the case, you would have thought that kli is really the mechanism for the violation by Avodah Zarah. Eleima, so you have to amend the Tanaic work that was brought here before Rabbi Yochanan to say, biyad patur b'kli chayav. When it comes to Avodah Zarah, if you do it by hand, you're going to be patur. If you do it b'kli, you're going to be chayav. The way that the Rivan explains this, and the Bali Tosafot basically explained it as well, in the name of the Kunchus, which is that if you do it in the way that this is the worship of such Avodah Zarah, then you're going to be chayav mitah for it. If you do it in a way that is not the normal Avodah for this Avodah Zarah, this is still included under those generic types of Avodot that apply to all Avodah Zarah. So therefore he says that biyad chayav derech avodata b'kach v'afilu avodat kochavim she'ein avodata b'kach chayav d'avoda gmurahi biyad. That's considered to be a full-fledged avoda, and now we flipped it, which is that by kli it's considered to be an avoda, whereas by a yad it's not considered to be an avoda. And so therefore if you do it k'darka, you're going to be in violation of avodah zarah, and you're going to get capital punishment. Now then, if you do it shalokadarka, which means that's not the normal way to worship the avodah zarah, but you do it anyway, then you're in violation of lota abdeim. So that tells you that in that situation, you're going to be chayav, despite the fact that this is not the normal way to worship the Avodah Zarah, similar to other avodot, like makriv on mizbeach, makriv ketoret, mishtachavet, which are these generic types of avodah that apply to all Avodah Zarah. And that's the chiddush over here, is that this is a type of an avodah that is so connected to Avodah Zarah, that if you do it to any Avodah Zarah, that's considered to be a violation. Chayav al rosh. We said before, Yachayv on the Rosh for stay peyot, for two peyot. Mechavi Rav Sheshet. Rav Sheshet pointed ben pirkei the ratio, between the prakim of the ratio of the head. So over here, he's saying that it is a place of a joint. And that becomes important over here because in terms of the peyot, a Rosh, according to most, It means peyot, mean a perek, mean a joint. If you want to find where the peyot hazakan are, or the peyot arosh, you're going to look for something that is a joint. And here the Rivan tells us, makom ha-prakim shemechabrim sham pirkei atzamot, v'ayinu b'tzda'im. Those are in the perek, the yuntar. Mishnah, he said, the temples. It's up here. It's at the joint between the jaw and the skull. Now, what's interesting about the Rivan Shita, because he mentions it as well by the Mishnah, is that you have to believe that at some point the Rosh ends, and at some point the Zakan begins. So your Shita with regards to where you think the Peyot HaZakan impact where you think the Peyot HaRosh end. What's interesting about the Rivan is that he says over here that the Peyot HaRosh are the temples, are over here. But then later on, as we described before, he tells us that the Peyot HaZakan are actually the 5 points along the bottom of the jaw. And in the Mishnah, he says, the point where the Zakan begins is where the Rosh ends. Which means that he thinks the Peyot HaRosh go from the temple down to the edge of your jaw. And the bottom edge of your jaw over here, that's all Peyot HaRosh over here. Because he says that the Peyot HaRosh ends where the Peyot HaZakan begins. For those who have the Peyot HaZakan, it's much higher up, which is at the bone or the joint between the lechi, between this and the skull, which is where, like Rashi and others have it, then that's the end of the Peyot HaRosh, also begins the Peyot HaZakan. And obviously as nafkaminot, because of the restrictions against Peyot HaZakan versus Peyot HaRosh, which we'll see in the Gemara Shvuot, which is that certain things with regards to Peyot HaRosh are restricted, even though they might be permitted by Peyot HaZakan. For instance, you might be able to shave your beard, cut it with scissors, but you may not be able to do that when it comes to Peyot HaRosh. There's a minimum shiur by Peyot HaRosh in terms of the length of the hair that it has to be, otherwise you're in violation. That minimum doesn't apply by the beard. Only thing that there is, it can't be, as we're going to see in 1 second, it can't be derech yiluach v'hashkata. So scissors wouldn't be a problem. So if you use scissors and cut very close, that might not be a problem by the beard, but it would be a problem by Peyot HaRosh. So it's important to know where the Rosh ends and where the Zakan begins. And so for the Rivan, interesting enough, even though he's makil by the Zakan, and he says the 5 points of the Zakan are all from the bottom corner of the bottom jaw, then to the center points over here, and then the center point over here, those are your 5 points of the Zakan, that means regarding Zakan, he's very makil. But being makil by the Zakan makes him machmir by Peyot HaRosh, because the Peyot HaRosh extends all the way down to the Peyot HaZakan. So he doesn't mention it here, but he mentions it on the Mishnah. Echad namata min ha'ozen, makom shalechi ha'taktoni yotze mitpareit sham, sham yikra pe'ah b'chodo shalechi shubolet l'chutz, sham matchalat ha'zakan. B'chol malam ad hatzda'im b'chlal pa'at ha'roshi. Everything from there up to the temple is considered pa'at ha'rosh. So that's the Rivan Shita again. So the more meiko you are gabei the zakan, the more machmir in a sense you are with regards to pa'at ha'rosh. If you shrink the zakan, at least the beginning points of it, then that will extend the pa'at ha'rosh. That's important to know. But that's, according to most, are in agreement that Peyot HaRosh are by the temples. The only question is, where does that end? I mean, for everybody else, that ends very close to there, because the bone that is actually that joint by the temple is the same point where the Peyot HaRosh ends and the Peyot HaZakan begins. And therefore, your Peyot HaRosh are much smaller. But for the Rivan, Peyot HaZakan is much lower down, and therefore the Peyot HaRosh is much longer. All right. Next is, Al HaZakan, Shtay Mikan, V'Shtay Mikan, V'Chat Mato. Ben Pirkei the Dikna. Same thing that he did by the Peyot HaRosh, he pointed to the joints of the beard. And so here again, you have, this is the machloket about what are considered to be the joints or the perek. Now you could read the perek or a joint in two different ways. The perek could be somewhere where you have a change in direction, which Rashi and the Rivan define as kitze, an edge or an end of something. Turning points. Perek, where the bone changes direction. Or it could be that a perek is literally a joint. It's where one bone ends and another bone begins. So in the face, you have the lower jaw bone, and you have the upper jaw bone and the skull. And so you have to look for joints along that continuum. See here, I'll show you some of the Rishonim's, the views of the Rishonim. The Rivan, as we noted before, already takes the 5 points to be, over here you can see, send these out, again, I think I sent them out before. You have the joint, which he describes over here as the turning point of the lower jaw. So it's not a joint, but it's a protrusion of the jaw over here. That's the turning point. And then you have, according to him, there is a little bone that sits here at the chin bone. And that the actual joints here, there's a bone that ends here for the lechi ha'tachton, a bone that ends here for these two protrusions, and then the middle bone.
So those are the 5 points for the Rivan in terms of the beard. Truthfully, we don't have that type of separation, although there is an indentation in the bone that is there in the chin, and almost everybody agrees that that point is the center point, or the fifth point for the beard. The Rivan over here suggests the other 2 points are next to it. On the other hand, you can see here Rashi. I'm saying the Rivan because over here the Rashi is the Rivan here in Makot. But Rashi in Shavuot, as well as what's quoted in the Rosh, and by others, the Shita of Rashi is much more familiar to us, which is at the 5 points that you have here. Again, the center chin is Shibot HaZakan that we spoke about before. That's the center point. The 2 points that begin are up here, up at the point where the jaw meets the skull. And that's the first point. And again, that would make his Peyat HaRosh also end over there. And then the 2 other points are here. If you feel along your cheeks, the protrusion of your cheekbone. That's where the other 2 points are, or that where the protrusion of the cheekbone happens. So you can feel those 2 points, and you can feel the point over here, and those are the 5 points according to Rashi. Then you have the Shitat, the Rabbeinu Hananel, which is, he has the same as Rashi in terms of the 2 points over here, which are between the jaw and the skull. But then he says the other 2 points are not the cheekbone protrusions, but rather the edge of the lips. So these are peyot, which are the peyot ha-safa, which are the edges of the mouth. And those are the other 2 points, and then the center point here. For him, it's interesting, I don't know, as to versus the Rambam, which we'll see in 1 second, for him, I don't know if the mustache is excluded from the beard or not. The Rambam is clearly excluded, and maybe in Farashi, but for here, for the Rabbeinu Hananel, it says that it's the edges of the lips. Does that mean these are the end points and everything to the outside, or does that mean that these are included, that everything here is included? It's not clear to me from the Rabbeinu Hananel about this. He's quoted in the Ritva, as well as in the Tur, the Shita to Rabbeinu Hananel. The Shita of the Rambam is less clear, but he mentions it both in the Perush Mishnayot as well as in the Yad Chazaka. He defines things as Lechi Ayelyon and Lechi Atachton, the upper jaw and the lower jaw. My assumption was that the upper jaw is the joint point here between the skull and the jaw. The lower jaw is the turning point, like the Rivan says over here, and then the Shibbolet the Zakan. So he has a similar Shita to the Rivan in terms of the 3 points down here, but then his other 2 points are up where Rashi's points were. That's what I assumed in the Shita of the Rambam. And then there is the Shita of Rashi, according to other Rishonim, which is that they kind of conflate between the Rivan and Rashi, which is that they have the 2 points that are here by the jaw that reaches the skull, the joint point up here by the ears, about the middle of the ears. Right? And then you have the 2 points that are at the end by the chin, here at the end of the lechi, and then the middle center point, like the Rivan had described, the 3 right in the middle, down below. So those are others who bring, by the Rosh, brings this as Neshitat Rashi, which, again, in Shavuot, doesn't sound like that is Shitat Rashi. As you can see here, they're all dealing with what is the definition of a perek. Right? You don't have that many joints. You don't have 5 joints in your face to speak about, because the joints are really between the upper jaw and the lower jaw, which are connected to the skull. But other than that, there aren't so many joints. So you have to be talking about more than just joints. You have to be talking about turning points. Perek, where the bone changes direction. The defining points are either tachat ha-ozen, which means it's below the ear, across from the upper part of the ear, or it's level with the eyes, in that they're trying to give you definitions of where the peyot are, so you can see that in their descriptions over here, trying to give the location of these points. So whether that means the cheekbones themselves, where they protrude in the front, or that means the edge of the lips, that means the chin, which has protrusions and then a centerpiece to it, or does that mean, like the Rivan suggests over here, tachat ha-ozen, below the ear, by the edges, where the edge of the lechi ha-tachton, the bottom jaw, turns over there. And you see the Rishonim giving you all those different options. And so the Rambam makes a point to say that the safa, even though the minhag is not to shave one's mustache, that based on his shita, there's no problem, the mustache, because the points are all on the external points. There's nothing in the center or in the middle for points for the Rambam. Therefore, the mustache is not included in the peot ha-zakan. All right, so that's just a review of what the 5 points are. Rabbi Elazar omer, imnat lan, if you took them off, then you're only in violation of one. Kasavar chad lavu. It says that it's all one lav. So even though it says that you're not allowed to remove upekat, upaat zikanam lo yigalechu, or lo tashkidet paat zikanecha. So even though paat, we said over here, includes 5 peot, the lav is only 1 lav. Don't do this to the peot hazakan.
That doesn't matter how many peyot that you hit in doing that violation, it's still only one violation. You only chayav if you remove it with a razor. This becomes important as the difference between pata rosh and pata zakan, because pata zakan, you're only in violation if you remove it with a razor. Pata rosh, you are in violation even if you do it with scissors, if you get below a certain length. I mean that the length of the hair by the pata rosh is important. Generally, the definition of hair is something where you can be hofech rosho leikaro. You can flip over tip of the hair to the root of the hair. As long as you can turn it back and touch the root of the hair, that's considered to be hair. That's the definition of what we find by Nazir. For instance, if he has to shave his head, how long does the hair have to be to consider to be hair that he can shave? Or if he shaves hair less than that length, is that considered to be a giluach? So that was the definition. So that's the same thing over here. Pata rosh, the restriction is against removing the hair of the rosh. You have to have hair by the pata rosh. Hair means something where you can have the end of the hair touch the ikar of the hair. That's basically the basic definition of what hair is. By the zakan, we have a different definition because of the terms that are used there, which is ufaz zakanam lo yigalechu. It has to be giluach. And the other one is lo tashchit efad zakanecha, which is not what is used by rosh. By rosh it says lo takifu. You're not allowed to square out the pa'at rosh. Over there, it doesn't define for you the mechanism. Anything that squares out the pata rosh, removes the hair there, is problematic. By the zakan, there's specifically hashchata, and there is giluach. And that's what the Gemara is going to define over here. We saw this already in the Gemara in Kiddushin, which is, Tan Rabbanan, upa'at zakanam lo yigalechu. You may not shave them. Yochal afilu bilcho b'misparayim yechayav. You would think if you shaved it, removed it with scissors, you'd be chayav. Tamalomer lo tashchit. It says, do not destroy it. Ilo tashchit. If you said destroy it, yocholim lakto b'mlakeit. Very hitni. If you took it off, either with a tweezer or a plane, yei chayav, you'd be chayav. Tamalomer lo yigalecho. You may not shave them. So over here, it's not clear what the deficit of milakeit and rehitni are. The easiest way to read it is simply that people don't call that shaving. When you want to be viluach, someone wants to cut. Viluach, they're not shaving in the modern sense. Shaving here means to cut one's hair. Either you cut the hair with a razor, or you cut it with scissors. Those are the normal ways that people remove hair. Taking it out with a tweezer, or taking it out with a plane, is just not the normal way to take out hair. And that's why it's not called viluach. That's a simple way to read it. There are those that suggest that the deficit here is that they don't cut. They uproot the hair, and that's the problem. Viluach means to cut, not to uproot. Tweezers and the plane pull the hairs out from the root. And that's the deficit in Malakit and Rehitni. So how can you be in violation? Giluach sheyesh bo hashkata. It has to be a giluach that has bo hashkata. Avi Omer, the only thing that qualifies for that is zetar. That is a razor. So according to the first reading we had, what you need here is something that is a normal tool of cutting hair, plus you need it to be something that's hashkata. Something that removes the hair. Hashkata means it cuts the hair to the point where it's level with the skin. That there is no separation between the cutting mechanism and the skin. That's what cuts the hair. So the only thing that qualifies to that bad is a tar. A tar qualifies because it's both giluach, it's a normal way of cutting, and it cuts so close to the skin that it levels the hair with the skin. The malakit and the rehitni would qualify as hashkata because they remove the hair to the point where it's level with the skin. The problem is that they're just not called giluach. Now then, the other way we formulated it, the tar is successful because the tar does not uproot the hair. It simply cuts the hair, but it cuts it so close to the skin that it's called giluach and hashkata. The scissors fail because they're not hashkata, and the malakit rehitni fail because they're not giluach. They're not cutting. They're uprooting, and that's their failure over here, is that they're pulling the hair out. They're not cutting the hair. And this is very important. Always discuss this when we go to this topic. The scissors, or the allowance for scissors, is what permits shaving for us today. Which is, they conceptually, why the scissors are not considered to be tar, or hashkata, is because the way a scissor works is that you have a stationary blade, and then you have a cutting blade. You always need counter pressure in order to cut. So a razor uses your skin as the counter pressure in order to cut the hair. So as you move the razor along, the friction or the pressure from the hair allows the razor to catch the hair and cut it off. For a scissor, the counter pressure is always the other blade. You need two blades, and by definition, there will be hair left because the width of the lower blade
will be the amount of hair that's left, because it can't cut below the level of the lower blade. And so that's what makes a difference between a scissor and a razor, and that's what allows one to shave. The way that shavers work is that they have a screen on top of the razors. That screen on top of the razor is the equivalent of the stationary blade on a scissor. And so what it does is the razor cuts anything that comes through the screen. So the screen creates the stationary blade, and then the razors inside cut using the friction or the pressure against the counterpressure of the screen in order to cut. So you have different types of screens, but for that reason, just to mention, because they recently passed away, but Rosen had written a kuntris from Somet about shaving, and it basically speaks to this point. It's almost impossible to have a shaver that's not kosher, because a shaver works in that manner. By definition, the way it cuts is it's cutting against a stationary object and not against the skin. If it in some way used the skin as the counterpressure, it would be problematic. But that's not how electric shavers work. And then for that reason, he thought that every electric shaver could be kosher, as opposed to some will believe that the lift and cut systems are problematic because the lift and cut systems that Norelco and Phillips use pull the hair in to the point where the cut is so close to the skin that it is problematic. Now, it doesn't mean that it uses the skin as the counterpressure. And that's why Reb Rosen believed that they were all kosher, because it's still cutting like a scissor. No matter how close it's getting, it's still cutting like a scissor. As opposed to those who think that there is a cut. Sometimes when you cut with scissors, they're so close that it's considered to be problematic. And so you have tshuvot like that, which first of all say, if you move the bottom blade instead of the top blade, that might be very problematic. Or if you have scissors that are very sharp, that can act like a razor, then even scissors could be problematic. And then that leads Rishonim in the Tshuvot also to mention the fact that if you cut with scissors like a razor, so like a razor doesn't mean it's acting like a razor, or is it cutting as close as a razor? So some believe that the problem is as close as a razor, then it becomes a problem. And that's where the issues with the lift and cut systems or shavers that cut too close to the face are maybe problematic. Not because they're acting like a razor, but they're simulating the effect of a razor, which is cutting very close to the face. Yechiel points out, and this was in the old days, we'll call it, and they wanted to test whether a shaver was really cutting by counterpressure to the screen or was cutting by the sharpness of the blade of the shaver. They used to write with ink on one's finger and put the shaver over there and run it. And you would know whether it was using the friction against the skin or not by whether it erased the pen that was written there. If the screen always blocks between you and the razor, it's never going to touch the skin there, and the marking that you put there will never change. Now then, if the razor is sharp enough that it's cutting through the sharpness of the razor, not the screen, then it would start to erase that which you have there because it's using the skin as counterpressure for the razor. So that was the test that people used. I think in some senses it's moot because that's by definition how shavers work. They all work by definition using the screen as a counterpressure. And so it's very hard to have a situation in which the razor is going to cut the skin or you're going to feel that pressure against the skin. People who shave with electric shavers do get irritation from that shaving, which means that there is something going on over there. And that's the question which comes up, which is, why is there irritation of the skin if the razor is never touching the skin? And that might have to do partly with the lift and cut systems that pull the hair towards you so the skin gets pulled out, and also the rubbing against the face, even of the screen, sometimes is irritating, not just the cutting of the blades. But that is an easy test to tell you whether the blade is touching the skin or not, is to write on the finger and to see if it erases. But it disagrees and says, what does he do? If he learns the gzeres shava, which I didn't note before, but is the way that you get both of these to be together, which is that the pasuk says, which is written in Parshat Emor by the Kohanim, and what is written in Kedoshim, which is Lotashchit et Bat Zekanecha, the word Peah Peah creates Gzeres Shava. And that's why we have the Hashkata and the Giluach have to be together because of that Gzeres Shava. So Gemara says, look, if he learns that Gzeres Shava, Libayitar, then he should require a razor. Ilo Gamir Gzeres Shava. If he doesn't learn the Gzeres Shava, Misparim Namilo, then you should be restricted in scissors. That means each one separately is a restriction. Hashkata is a restriction, and so is Giluach. That means even scissors would qualify. Why just Melakeit and Mehitni? Anything that is either Migaleach or Mashchit should be disqualified.
The Olam Gamir Gzeira Shava. So he says, no, that this is the Gzeira Shava is in place, but he believes the Malakait and Rehitni also are called Giluach. So that is, depending on what you thought Giluach was before. If you thought Giluach was, that's the way that people normally cut, he thinks that people cut or take off hair that way with a tweezer or with a plane. People do cut their hair that way, and therefore it's considered to be Giluach. It's under the definition of Giluach. According to those that said that Giluach means to cut and not to uproot, he believes that the tweezer or the plane don't necessarily uproot the hair, that they leave it in some form that's there, and so that's why they would qualify over here. Okay, next Mishnah, which, it's interestingly enough, has changed dynamic over time, which is that in the past, when it came to Ktovet Kaka, which was tattoos, that was relegated to the fringes of society. Today, it's become much more a mainstream part of society for people to get tattoos, and it is a violation of an Isur de Oraita, and so now it's become much more of an issue or forefront issue, this problem of Ktovet Kaka, which is a Kotev Ktovet Kaka, one who gets a tattoo, Tav Velo Kaka, if you write, meaning you put the ink in without doing the Kaka. The Kaka is the cutting of the skin, which is necessary in order for the ink to become indelible, is that the ink has to then sit between the skin and the flesh. That's how a tattoo stays and is not erased, is if you get the ink to enter between layers of this, the skin and the flesh. So the writing itself of the ink without the cutting, or kaka velok tav, or the cutting without of the writing, enu chayav. You're not chayav ad shi yichtov veyikakeya. You have to actually write and then do the cutting, which is mean you have to put the ink in and then make the ink indelible so that it stays on the body and it forms what we know today as a tattoo on the body. Biado ubikichol ubichol davar shuhuroshem. So now, whether you write here biado will then influence what you think the next word means. Biado means that even if he does it by hand, and then ubikichol would be the applicator, which is a kechol is a applicator that puts on makeup, and therefore the word here would be the applicator if you use that, b'chol devar shuroshem, or anything that makes the cut. Then if you read the word here, not to be yado, but rather dyo, which means ink, then it would be bit ink, ubik kechol would not be the applicator, but the makeup. It's a blue coloring that they used to put on their eyes, the eyeshadow, then that would be the ink that you're using, or the type of coloring that you're using is kechol, or any ink that leaves a marking. So depending how you read the first word, whether it's yado or dio, then that would make a difference as to what you think the remainder of the words mean in the Mishnah. Until you write there, the name. So now, what's the question is, of course, which the Gemara will ask right away, what is the name that you write there? Shnemar, uchtovet kakalot nubachem ani Hashem. Don't put a tattoo there, I am Hashem, your God. So your first inclination, and that will come up in the Gemara right away, is to say that he's saying you may not tattoo God's name on your body. Now, that might seem far-fetched, although, we'll see in a second. Amalei Ravacha Brei Derova LeRav Ashi, Adi Yichtov Ani Hashem Mamash. Does that mean that he has to write Ani Hashem? That's one way to read it. Or the other way is just Shem Hashem. Meaning that he literally has to write God's name on his arm in order to be Chayav. That's what it sounds like from the end of the Mishnah. So Amalei Lo. Until you write the name of the Avodah Zarah. Nemar, Uchtovet Kaka, Lo Titnu Bachem, Ani Hashem. I am Hashem your God, Ani Hashem, Velo Acher. That's what it's telling you. I am your God and no one else. Now the tattoo was used, and it still is influential today in terms of tattoos, which is that, for instance, for slaves. They used to tattoo slaves, and they do it for animals as well when they brand an animal, they identify the animals belonging to these Baalim. A tattoo was also a way of identification. You put a tattoo on an individual to identify them as the property of this individual. So you can put a tattoo with slaves, they would do that. They treat them as property, unfortunately, right, with the numbers in the Holocaust, where they were treating people not as people, but as animals, then they tattooed them with numbers as a mark of identification, but identifying them to be subservient to something else. And so when one dedicated themselves to the Avodah Zarah, they used to get a tattoo of the Avodah Zarah, which indicated that you belong to this Avodah Zarah. You're dedicated to this Avodah Zarah. That's obviously the problem. And now you can understand maybe why there's a restriction possibly against putting the Shem Hashem. Meaning that that's the way the old Avodah Zarah do it.
You don't do that yourself. Don't put the shame of Shem on you. That's not the way that we identify with God, by putting tattoos on our bodies saying that we belong to God. That's not our mechanism. Now, again, the Gemara then rejects it, but now you can understand what the Havamina was, that you shouldn't act like the way that the people of Avodah Zarah act. That's not the way that Hashem wants you to dedicate yourself to Hashem. And again, tattoos today have that. Even when it's done by sailors with regards to a woman, other religions, they tattoo themselves in a way that shows some sort of dedication to that individual. So here, there's the restriction of Kovei Kaka. Also from this, you see that there's a clear association between tattooing and Avodah Zarah, which is the restriction. Now, the Rivan over here says, Ketovei Kaka, Gzeret HaKatuv. It is a Gzeret HaKatuv. There's no reason given. And it's something that it's a chok, and that's it. The Rambam, on the other hand, connects it specifically, like the Gemara here does, to Avodah Zarah. And he sees it as a derivative problem, Avodah Zarah, like the Rambam sees for many of these Yisurim that are chukim, that we don't understand, like Kilayim and other things. He connects them to Avodah Zarah. And here, too, the Gemara itself does it, but connects it to a practice of Avodah Zarah. And therefore, it's chukot ha'akum. And it's a problem of acting like Avodah Zarah. And that's the restriction or the problem over here. Obviously, it's a din d'oraita, and we don't differentiate based on the tam. Therefore, tattooing is restricted legamrei, with the exception of what you noted over here, which are for medical reasons, which I think they'd use markings again for the chemotherapy. Either because it is pikuach nefesh, or some rishonim believe that the iser here is only tiva, which is a sore, not when you're just making markings on the body. And also, the problem comes up now today because it's become much more prevalent or accepted in society in terms of tattoos, that many balei tshuva are individuals who have tattoos and have to deal with it. So it happens to be that one of the people that had signed up for my Daf Yomi, his name that he signed up was Tattoo Man. The person who had connected him to me said it was a balei tshuva that was the Tattoo Man before he was a balei tshuva. But that was his nickname, or his nickname was the Tattoo Man. But obviously he had tattoos. So for balei tshuva, there's nothing inherently that the tattoo makes that's problematic. It was problematic. It was a violation of the din d'oraita, but there's no din d'oraita that persists once you have the tattoo on. Now, many people want to remove them afterwards, and today there are procedures or laser surgeries that allow you to remove it. It's painful and difficult, but there are those abilities today that weren't in the past, and people might want to remove them just because of the unsightliness or the busha that's associated with them because they're not accepted necessarily in the religious realms. Amar Rav Malkia, Amar Rav Adar Bava, Asur La'adam Shitein Efer Makle Al Gavi Makato. Person may not put, now here it's ashes of makle, which means from burning wood or burning a staff, that you can't put that on a makle, you can't put that on an injury or a wound. Which there, the reason being is that if you have a wound and then you put ashes on them, or this type of ash, it is blackening in nature, and then it will simulate the effect of getting a tattoo there. Because if you put the Efer Makle there, it's going to simulate a ketovet kaka, mipnei shenireit ketovet kaka. It looks like a tattoo. Even though it's not a tattoo, it does look like a tattoo, or may simulate the effects of a tattoo, and that's why it's problematic. Now, whether the problem is specific to Efer Makle, which is that what the Rivan seems to indicate, that Efer Makle has this particular property to it, Dafka Kamar, he says specifically, Efer Makle, the fish kashehi. It's very hard. Umikakat mekoma makke. And it kind of rips up the place where the injury is. Varoshem, nirechsham acharzman. And the roshem, the marking still stays there after time. Aval afar ba'almalo. But any other dirt or anything like that is not as abrasive. And therefore it doesn't cut into the wound. And therefore it's not problematic. So the Rivan sees this very particular to Efer Makle, although other Rishonim see it as a broader statement, just Efer Makle happened to be what they used, but any dirt or any item that you would place on the wound that would have the same effect would also be problematic. The Rivan sees it as Efer Makle having the properties that make it problematic, and that's why the Gemara specified it over here. So now Amar Rav Chanina, or the way we have in our Gemara is Amar Rav Nachman, and the way that the Bach brings it down is Rav Chinina, so you have three options as to who the individual is here. Breid Rav Yika, Shiput, Shvachot, Vigumot, Rav Malkio. Blorit, Efer Makle, Vigvina, Rav Malkia. So you have two Amoraim who have very similar names, Rav Malkio and Rav Malkia. And we have Memrot that are said over from them. And what Rav Nachman and our Gemara here, Breid Rav Yika, is laying out is which was attributed to Rav Malkio,
and which was attributed to Rav Malkiah. He says the following, Shipud, which is eaten by Yom Tov, the spit upon which you cook the meat, after you're finished using the spit, it is mukseh, and therefore you remove it, Shom Tov, you pull it out from the meat, and then you leave it on the side, you can't move it around anymore. Shvachot is a mishnah in Ketubot, which is that no matter how many maidservants a woman brings into a marriage, she's still obligated to do some work because it is problematic for a person to be not working at all, because that type of shimum, as the Mishnah says, leads to bad things, both from a mental state as well as in terms of behavioral state. And so no matter how many shvachot a woman brings into a marriage, she still has to do certain things within the house. Vigumot is the question by Shtei Se'arot in the Gemara Nida, where you're trying to identify if someone's reached the age of puberty. The threshold is Shtei Se'arot, two pubic hairs. There the Gemara has an opinion that gumot doesn't even have to be the hair, it just has to be the hair follicles are enough to identify that the person's reached puberty. Even though there are no hairs there, the gumot themselves, the follicles, make it that we assume there were hairs there. So he says all three of those were attributed to Rav Malkiah. Blorit, which is a case in Avodah Zarah, if a person is cutting someone who has a blorit, which is this type of mohawk haircut that has a big ponytail in the back, and it was usually dedicated to Avodah Zarah, it says there that the Jewish barber has to stay away from touching the blorit if he's cutting someone with such a haircut. So he has to stay at least three etzba'ot away from the blorit. Efer Makleh is our Gemara over here. And Gvina is the restriction against eating cheeses that are made by non-Jews, because the Gemara there says, Machlip Penehem, that they put fats over the face of the cheese, and those fats are non-kosher. So the problem is not the cheese itself inherently, because only kosher milk will curdle to the point where it'll become cheese, but nevertheless, because of other problems in the processing, as well as in they're putting the non-kosher fats on top afterwards, you can end up with cheeses that are not kosher because of the way that, first of all, they curdle the cheese. They can do it in a manner that's using non-kosher stimulants in order to create the curdling, as well as the fact that they put the fats on afterwards, that makes it non-kosher. Those are all Rav Malkiah, according to this statement. They all have attribution to Rav Malkiah. But Papa Amar, Matznitin u'matznita. Any statement that's associated with a Mishnah or is associated with the Braita, Rav Malkiah. Those are assigned to Rav Malkiah. Shmaitita, Rav Malkiah. On the other hand, if it's just a plain statement, independent of a Mishnah or a Braita, then those are all Rav Malkiah. But Simanech, this is the Siman to remember. Matnita Malkata, that the Mishnayot or Tanaic works are the queen. And so then the Rav Malkiah, whose name is like Malka, so the queen, and the Mishnayot and Braito, the Tanaic works, are connected. Therefore, the attribution of the Mishnayot and the Braito go to Rav Malkiah, and then everything else is Rav Malkiah. My Benayu, what's the napkamina between these two listings? Ige Benayu, Shvachot. The difference between them is Shvachot. Now here, this leads to a machloket between Rashi and the Balei Tosafot and other places. The Rivan over here actually brings both opinions, which is the fact that in the first list that we had with Rav Malkiah, Shipud is a Shmaitata. Shvachot is the Mishnah in Ketubot. Vigumot is also a Shmaitata. So in terms of the Shmaitata, Shipud and Gumot stay in place because they're both Shmaitata and their attribution is to Rav Malkiah. Shvachot is a Mishnah in Ketubot. It's a comment on a Mishnah. And so therefore we're moving that over now to Rav Malkiah. So that is one way to read it. That's the way Rashi reads it in Chas, that now only two of these will be attributed to Rav Malkiah, which is Shibud and Gumot. But Shvachot will move over to Rav Malkiah. On the other hand, Rabbeinu Tam says that if you go to the list of Rav Malkiah, Blorit is associated with the Braita. Efer Makleh, his argument over here, is a Shmaitata. It's not connected directly to a Mishnah. It's an independent statement. Vina is associated with a Mishnah. So now, what you have here is that within Rav Malkiah's statement, you have Efer Makleh, which is a Shmaitata. So what the Rabbeinu Tam says, you have to flip them. When we say that Shvachot move from Rav Malkiah to Rav Malkiah, also vice versa. From Rav Malkiah, Efrem Aklam moves to Rav Malkiah. And in that way, the Rabbeinu Tam says they still both have three attributed to them. They're just swapping Shvachot with Efrem Aklam. The other hand, the way Rashi reads it is that simply the Shipud from Rav Malkio moves over to Rav Malkia. That means that four of them will be attributed to Rav Malkia, and only two then will be attributed to Rav Malkio. Rav Bibi Bar Abaye copied Afilo Arivda de Kuslita. He was even makpid on the pricking that was done for the bloodletting. So he felt that that pricking that they did for the bloodletting could be a problem of ketovet kaka. Ravashi Amar Kol Makom Sheyesh Sham Makeh, Makato Mochiach Alav. Anytime you have an injury or a cut that is there, that proves that it's not ketovet kaka, and any marking or things that happen because of that are clearly associated with the wound and not associated with person tattooing themselves. So even if there are markings that are left from the treatment over there, that doesn't make it into a tattoo, and eventually it will wash away. Even though it might look like a tattoo for a period of time, it is not a tattoo, and over time it will dissipate or fade. And so that the Balei Tosfot would say, v'chein halacha. Halacha here is like Rav Ashi, where it's clear that the inking or whatever markings are there are directly connected to a wound, then you don't have to worry about it because people will know it's associated with the wound and not with the tattoo. And that's why it would be permitted. And that would free up the issue of Rivda de Kuslita, first of all, the markings that come from the pricking by the bloodletting tool, as well as possibly Efer Makler might be overcome by this as well. Okay, next Mishnah. Nazir Shayash Shute Yain Kol Hayom. You have a Nazir that's drinking wine all day long. Einu Chayav Ela Achat. He's only Chayav for one violation. So here, a person who warned him not to drink, and he continues to drink all day, we don't consider that to be a separate violation, but rather a single violation that continues all day. And in concert with their opinions before, Rashi over here believes that the violation is only on the first Rivi'it, but that's which is associated with the warning, and that's why you only Chayav Achat. Whereas for the Balei Tosafot, the reason you're only Chayav Achat is not because it's not a violation in each case, but rather because it's one Aveira that continues. Had it been in any way Gufim Mechulakim, where you could separate or delineate the item separately, then it would be a separate violation. But because over here it's the same action that's continuing, that's considered to be one long Aveira and not a separate Aveira, and that's why you're Chayav only one. Amrlo al tishteh, al tishteh. They said him, don't drink. Behushoteh. And he continues to drink. Chayav al kol achat ve'achat. Then he's chayav on every violation. And here you're chayav al kol achat ve'achat. That's even if you never stop drinking in between. As long as there's a warning at each point of time that you cover a revit, that will create a separate aveira. And the Rambam here in the Perush Mishnayot says, even if you give hachra in the beginning on a large jug or cup of wine, and it has multiple reviot in it, if you warn him that you're going to get a malkot for every reviot that you drink over here, you'll be loke on each one of those reviot separately. Hayam et tamei lemeitim, if he was becoming tamei lemeit, kol hayom, all day long. So here we're speaking about a nazir. Nazir has three restrictions. Restriction against grape and wine products, that's the first one we give as an example. The second one is not to become tamei tumatameit. And then the third one is giluach, which the Mishnah will get to next. Now we're in that middle ground, which is the amitameh meitim kol hayom. He's becoming tameh all day. Enu chayav ela achat. You only chayav for one. Amru lo al titameh, don't become tameh, don't come tameh. Hu mitameh chayav al kol achat v'achat. And then he continues to become tameh in each instance. He's chayav on each time that he becomes tameh. And as the Gemara points out in other places, like in Nazir, the violation by Tumah here is only if he releases from the Tumah and then touches it again. But if he continues to touch the Tumah that he was touching in the first place, there won't be an additional violation by staying touching that Tumah. As opposed to, as the Balei Tosafot point out over here, Tila'ayim, whereby even persistently wearing it will result in a violation every time you're worn while you're wearing it. There you don't need any hefsek in order to separate the wearing, to make it into a separate Aveira. That is because, as the Ramban points out, that once you touch the Tum'ah, the person is already profaned by the touching of the Tum'ah. He's Mechulal. As long as he stays attached to that Tum'ah, nothing is changing at this point in time. The violation has already happened, and what is remaining attached to that Tum'ah is no more of a violation. Once he releases from the Tum'ah, where then there's lesser level of Tumah, when he re-engages with the Tumah, then again, that is a
You have a separate action of profaning that makes you chayav, and that creates a new law. On the other hand, when it comes to wearing the beged kilayim, the isur is to wear the beged kilayim. As long as you wear it and persistently wear it, you're going to be in violation as you continue to wear it. You don't need any hefsek to separate between them, except for the fact that you have a shi'ur of levisha and hafshata.
And then on to the next one. Hayam galeach kol hayom, eno chayav ela achat. It's only chayav for one. Amru lo, al tigaleach. If he says, don't shave, ve'um galeach, and he continues to shave, chayav al kol achat v'achat. Then every warning will precipitate an additional violation. So even though these are seemingly the same, nevertheless, some would point out that there's a chiddush in each one of them that you would have not have thought. So the Aruch Daner explains over here what the progression of the chiddush is, and that is by shtiyat yayin by the nazir, even though it's a violation of his nazirut, he still remains a nazir. And therefore you could understand why there would be multiple violations. But then by tumah is oker his nazirut, and he has to restart his nazirut when he becomes tohor. So there you would think that becoming tamei multiple times would not have the same impact as drinking wine multiple times. And then, even by tumah, where you could find what's called increased levels of tumah, which is that you could say the case is a case where he elevated the tumah, and that's why there was a violation over here. Then we go to giluach. Giluach, which both interrupts the nazirut, because he can't continue until his hair has grown out. And that's something that you can't elevate the status of. You can't be more migulach than being migulach already. And therefore, this is, you would think that maybe there you can't have multiple violations of the giluach. So there you would think, again, only one violation, not multiple violations. And then upcoming, the kilayim adds on an additional factor, which is something that you can violate passively. Maybe there you would think that you can't have multiple violations. And the Mishnah comes in each of these cases to tell you you could still be in multiple violations of all of these isurim. Hayah lavush bikilayim kol hayom. He's wearing kilayim all day long. Enu chayav la'achat. You're only chayav once. Amru lo, al tilbash. Don't wear it. Ve'u poshet ve'lovesh. He takes it off and puts it on. Chayav al kol achad v'achad. He's chayav on each one. So over here, seemingly from the Mishnah, this is different than the other situations. So here, it's not just that he persists in the action that he's doing, but say he has to actually undress and get dressed again in order to be in violation. We'll see that the Gemara changes that to be more in line with the remainder of the Mishnah. Then the Mishnah says, Yesh koresh telem achat, someone who can plow a single furrow in the field, v'chayav alav mishum shmon alavin. And then he's in violation of 8 different negative commandments. Ha-choresh, someone who plows, v'shor v'chamor. Shor chamor is kilayim. You know how to hitch them up together to a single wagon, plow, tool, or mechanism. That's one violation. And the Rivan points out over here, you could, if you wanted to increase the lavim here, just say that he was doing it with multiple shvarim and chamorim. But he says that's not what the mission is after. The mission is not after just getting multiple lavim. It's getting different lavim for different shemot. So once it already got shor v'chamor, it doesn't want to add more for shor v'chamor. It wants to find other areas of halacha that are going to give you additional violations. Whereas others argue on this point and say that there is no separate violation. If one plows with multiple shvarim and chamorim, that's only one violation. That's not multiple violations. And that's why the Mishnah did not enumerate it. Behein mukdashim. And they are hekdesh. Now over here, the way that the Rivan explains it, you have one of two options over here. Behein mukdashim. One possibility is that we are speaking about a shor v'chamor, and the chamor is a peter chamor. It's according to those shittos that believe that it's a sword to get hana'ah from a peter chamor. And so the problem here is that the shor is a bechor, is a firstborn, and so is the chamor. And so you're doing a voda with them is a violation against that restriction against doing a voda with a bechor, which is lo tavod bechor shorecha. And that's how you get two violations here of muktashim. The other option is that shor and chamor is not literally. Shor and chamor is the lashon of the pasuk, and so that's why it uses shor and chamor. But you could pick any two animals that are not of the same min, like a shor and a seh, and you could say the same thing over there, that the shor and the seh, both bechorot, then they would be in violation of bechor of the shor and bechor of the seh. That's the other possibility. Or another possibility is, like Rashi and Pesachim, the shor and the chamor we're speaking about here are both kodesh, but they're kodesh in different ways. The shor is kodesh, bikdushat bechor, whereas the chamor is kodesh,
Bikdushat Berek Abayit. It was donated to the Mikdash for its monetary value. And the restriction violated over here is working with the Bechor. And the other one is being Mazid Bimi'ila. Is intentionally taking Hana'ah, misappropriating things from Hekdesh for your own benefit. And therefore you'd be in violation of the Din of Mi'ila. So that would give you then two Lavin. The Baal Tosafot reject all of those. And therefore, he says that there's only one violation here by the Shor V'chamor Mukdashim, which is the problem that the Shor is a Bechor. Therefore, he has to add on an additional one in the next item of the Mishnah, which is Ubikilayim Hakbekerem. It's Kilei Kerem, which is that he's planting there, where he's covering over seeds that are going to be grape seeds along with grains, which would be a violation of Kilei Kerem. And the way that the Baal Tosafot, the Rambam here in the Perush of Mishnayot, explain it is, Aval Bikilei Kerem, he could bet Malkot. The Marishaya Zoreya Bekerem Chita Sora Bechartzan. It's a case where he's placing down Chita, wheat, Sora, barley, and Chartzan, grape seeds, Bechipa Utam Bemachresha. And he's covering them over with the plow. Gavre Vitarte is in two violations. Chad Mishum Zoreya Kilei Zraim. One of them is a problem that he's actually planting Kilayim. Oh, the Zera Kilei Akerem. In addition to that, he's in violation of Kilei Akerem. So, those would over here suggest that there is a problem of Kilei Zraim, just between one of the items and the Chartzan. And separately, there's a problem of Kilei Akerem when you have all three of them together, based on the Shita, that Kilei Akerem is only a violation when you have two grains plus a Chartzan in order to be in violation. So he thinks you have two violations there by Kilei Akerem. The Shvi'it, it is the seventh year where you're in violation of planting during the Shvi'it. The Yom Tov, it happens to be Yom Tov, and therefore you're in violation of doing a melacha on Yom Tov. The Kohen, the Nazir, this person is a Kohen and a Nazir, the Beit HaTumah. And the area where he's doing the plowing is a place that is full of Tumah, so therefore he is profaned his priestly side, as well as his side of being a Nazir. Hananiah ben Achinai Omer, Afalovesh Kilayim. Have him being wear Kilayim, and you can get nine instead of eight. Amalo Eino Hashem. It's not part of the item that he is working on. We're trying to say he takes one action, and that single action obligates him in eight violations. So there, wearing Kilayim is not part of the plowing process to say that's enumerated in this list. Amalahem, Afnazir, Lohu Hashem. You can say the same thing about Kohen and Nazir, which is they have nothing to do with his plowing. They have to do with the status of the individual and the place and the location, so that's why you're Chayav. Although you could argue that plowing in this location affects this type of person. It's best to wearing Kilayim, which has nothing to do with the plowing or the location at all, and therefore you could separate between them. So now, Amarav Bibi, Amarav Yossi. The other gears over here is Amarav Bibi, Amarav Asi. And probably the right way to read it is, lo poshet velovesh, lovesh mamash. So it's not when you say in the Mishnah, it means poshet and puts it back on. That doesn't mean literally that he takes it off and puts it back on. Afilu machnis umotzi beit yad unkali shalo. It's even if he is simply putting his arm in, taking his arm out, putting his head through the collar and taking the collar back out, or he maybe is buttoning and unbuttoning the item. Any of those would be considered to be enough to be considered an action of levisha, and that you'd be chayav for kilayim for. Mechavi Ravacha Brei Ravika Iyule Vafuke. Ravacha Brei Ravika disagreed and said that Iyule Vafuke. He indicated, he didn't say, but he indicated if you take it off completely and put it on completely to be in violation. That's seemingly the simple interpretation of the Mishnah. Ravashi Omer Afilo Shaha Elchidim Shod V'Levosh Chayav. Rav Ashi comes up with a huge chiddush. We pass in the halacha, which is normative, which is that you are in violation of kilayim, not just when you put it on, but when you continue to wear it. And the defined shiur for wearing it that you will be chayav is the amount of time it will take you to take it off and put it on. So if you continue to wear it over time with that shiur, then you're going to be chayav on each time that you persistently wear it. And that's what the Mishnah said. That as long as you can take it off and put it back on, doesn't mean literally take it off and put it on, but if you're wearing it for the amount of time it would take to take it off and put it on, that's a new violation of kilayim. Therefore, it's what we call an averat midit, as opposed to what we have by mitzvot, like tefillin and tzitzit, which are what we call mitzvot midit, which are mitzvot that you do on a consistent basis. When you're wearing tefillin, every moment you're wearing tefillin, you're doing a mitzvah. By tzitzit, every moment you have the tzitzit on, you're doing a mitzvah. Mezuzah. As long as you have a mezuzah up, every moment you're doing a mitzvah. So we also have aveirot that act that way. And this is one of them, kilayim. As long as you're wearing kilayim, as you continue to wear kilayim, you are violating over and over again the restriction of kilayim. The easiest way to understand this is that there is an isur not only in putting on the beged, but there's a isur of being lavush, being dressed in the beged, and then you need a shiur to define how long is it being dressed in the beged. Whereas the Balei Tosafot over here suggests that the necessity for the undressing and dressing waiting period is in order to separate from the original dressing that you did and make this into a separate violation. Because if you couldn't take it off and put it back on, this wouldn't be considered a separate violation. And they're deeming it as if you are taking it off and putting it on in each instance. And therefore he has to contrast that or separate that from other instances where we don't require shihiyah, because whatever you're doing is an action at every moment. And therefore, that action is enough to separate out the issue, whereas over here, since there's no separate action, you need the shihiyah to create that separation, according to the Balei Tosafot. Yesh choresh kelam echad. Amar Rabbi Yanai, b'chabura nimnu v'gamru. And the Rabbi Yanai calls the chabura over here, whether they had a weekly meeting, or these were a group of individuals that got together. In terms of the Yom Avad, it was a gathering day, or a day where they had pre-planned types of drashot that came about. So they were all together. Someone who covers over kilayim is lokeh. So the restriction against kilayim is planting kilayim. And now they're saying that even if you just cover over, you didn't do the zuriyah, you didn't put it into the ground, but you plowed over it, or you covered it over, that is a violation of planting kilayim. Amalan Rabbi Yochanan, ulav mishnatenu hizo. So Rabbi Yochanan says to them, isn't that our mishnah? Yesh choresh telem echad, v'chayav lav mishum shmone lavim. Ha choresh v'shor v'chamor, v'hein muktashim v'kilayim v'kerem. Hai choresh d'mechayev v'shum kilayim hefa mishkachaba. What's the case when he's plowing, and he's going to be chayav v'kilayim v'kerem? Lav d'mechseh v'adei d'azil. Isn't it because he's covering over the seeds as he's going by? Zamrulei, they said to Rabbi Yochanan, ilav d'dalayla chaspo. If you weren't here to pick up that shard of property, mi mashkachet marganita tuta, we wouldn't have found that precious pearl that was underneath it. So you opened our eyes to see that the Mishnah confirmed or verified what we were saying. And so Rabbi Yanai is complimenting Rabbi Yochanan over here for bringing in the Mishnah as a proof. But one, it felt really good. Amrali Rish Lakish, Rabbi Yochanan. Rish Lakish, his Talmud Chover, leads over to Rabbi Yochanan and says, Yilav de Kilsach Gavarabo. Had it not been for the fact that a great man like Rabbi Yanai complimented your bringing in the Mishnah, Havamina Matznita Mani, I would have thought the author of our Mishnah is whom? Rabbi Kivai, Damar Mikayim Kilayim Lokeh. Because he says anybody who sustains Kilayim gets Malkot. My Rabbi Kiva, what's this Rabbi Kiva that we're speaking about? Titania, Haminakesh, Bamechapeh, someone who weeds, someone who covers over Kilayim, Lokeh. Rabbi Kiva Omer, Afam Mikayim. So Rabbi Kiva is the author of the entire bright over here. That's based on Rava's Shita and Moed Katan, that those are violations of Choresh, and that's why they have to be assigned to the opinion of Rabbi Kiva, according to Rabbi Yosef, who thinks they're violations of Zoreya. The first two items also could be according to the Chachamim. But Rabbi Kiva adds on that it also includes Mikayim. If you sustain Kilayim, you let it grow, you let it continue to grow, you're in violation of Kilayim. My time at the Rabbi Kiva. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Kiva's position? Tatanya, Sadcha lo tizra kilayim. Your field you may not plant with kilayim, which would sound like Enliela Zoreya. That's only if you planted your chayav. Mikayim minayin. How do I know if you sustain the kilayim after it's planted? That's problematic. Tamalomar, kilayim sadcha lo. That your sadeh may not contain kilayim in it. Which is that they are reparsing the pasuk based on behem tcha lo tarbea kilayim. Sadcha lo tizra kilayim. They're taking the kilayim from the behemah and associating it with the sadcha, which is kilayim sadcha lo, in reparsing the pasuk that you have now, any kilayim in your sadeh lo is a violation of a lav. And so that's how Rabbi Akiva learns the fact that you're also restricted in b'mikayim kilayim. So that's why Reish Lakish says to Rabbi Yochanan, I'm not sure why the Mishnah is approved. The Mishnah might be shitat Rabbi Akiva, which is a dat yachid, and so you can't prove anything from the Mishnah because the Rabbanan who disagree and say Mikayim Kilayim is not Chayav,
They would disagree with this Mishnah. If they disagree with this Mishnah, then you don't have a proof from this Mishnah to what you said before, that a mechapeh, someone who covers over kilayim, is chayav for violation of kilayim. So Amalei Ula the Rav Nachman, Vililke Nami Mishum Zoreya B'Yom Tov. Why aren't you also chayav for planting on Yom Tov? Why is it only choresh over here? He's plowing over these seeds, and therefore he's chayav choresh on Yom Tov. Let us say that he's also chayav because of planting. Amalei Tana Vishier. Rav Nachman answers him, yeah, you know what? The Tana didn't give an exhaustive list. There are other things he could have included, but he didn't include here. So Amalei, he says back to him, Tana, Tani Shmona. The Tana writes, there are 8. Vatamar Tana Vishier. And you're saying that it's not an exhaustive exact list, then why give a number of 8 if this isn't an absolute number or it's not a number that is specific to the case? If you think there are more items that are included here, then it shouldn't say Shmona. It just should say you violate these lavin and not count them or enumerate them, because then you would be deceivingly telling people that there are only these 8. So he says it can't be that. So Amalei Rava or Amalei Rabba, depends on which gears you have over here. Yesh. Chiluk melachot b'Shabbat, ain't chiluk melachot b'Yom Tov. This is something that we discussed before, which is that when you're in violation of melachot on Shabbat, we generally believe that's what's called chiluk melachot. That means if you do multiple melachot on Shabbat, you're going to be chayav multiple times. Again, when you're dealing with death penalties, it's less meaningful. But when you're dealing with shogeg and bringing korbanei chataot, over there it is meaningful. How many chataot do you have to bring if you have multiple violations of melachot on Shabbat? If you think there's no chiluk melachot, then you'd only bring one chatat for any violation of Shabbat, because they'd all be included in the same violation or problem. So if one forgetting, you do 2 violations, you don't have to bring a single chatat. Now then, if you believe there's chiluk melachot, for every melacha, then you would have to bring a separate chatat. That's what the Mishnah in the 7th perek of the Gemara Shabbat says, is that if you violate all 39 melachot, you're going to be bringing 39 chataot, because there is chiluk melachot. Which is not true by Yom Tov. By Yom Tov, the violation is simply lo tasu kol melacha, kol melacha tavoda lo tasu. You may not do any work on Yom Tov. And that violation is a single violation no matter how many melachot you do. Now, as the Rivan points out, there are 2 different ways that chiluk melachot are learned out by Shabbat. One of them is lo tvaru eish b'chol moshuetechem b'yom haShabbat. That's why did the Torah delineate havara separately? And from that, they learned that there is chiluk melachot by Shabbat. Now, that's obviously only written by Shabbat, and it won't have application by Yom Tov. Because lo tvaru eish is something that is permitted on Yom Tov, so you're not going to have chiluk melachot. Or that they believe havara was lalav yatzat, that you only get malkot for it and not mita for violation of havara on Shabbat. V'nafkale chiluk melachot mi vasa chat mehena. The pasuk that we find by the chatat, that if you do one of these, you can only use that as a chiluk melachot, something that's chayav chatat, which is a violation of Shabbat, because it has mita and karet associated with it. But a violation of Yom Tov, which is a plain lav, doesn't have a chatat associated with it, and therefore you can't say that the chatat is your source for chiluk melachot by Yom Tov. And there it learns it from achat mehena, means one that is many, or many that are one. The Gemara over there, it says you can have many violations, they only end up with one chatat. One violation, it ends up with many chataot. And there, the Gemara Mishnah in Shabbat deals with that, as well as in other places in Shas. The Gemara describes what exactly is meant. Me'achat, me'heina, there are 4 drashot that come out of there. One of the drashot is that you are chayav for each violation of a melacha. That is chiluk melachot. But both of those are only applicable by Shabbat. They are not applicable by Yom Tov. Over here in the Gilyan of Shas, Rabbi Akiva Eiger asks, Kashu the lokay nami mishom bechoresh mishom mechamer achar behem tov. Why aren't you chayav for driving an animal on Shabbat, or here it's going to be Yom Tov? Mechamer is an isur lav. It doesn't have isur mita associated with it, but it's a violation on Shabbat. So he says ulochora muhach mizet. He says from this you might conclude that shvitat behemo ud mechamer inu biyom tov. The restriction of shvitat behema and Mechamer, which applies by Shabbat, is not applicable by Yom Tov. And then he points you to the halachic authorities to go see how that fits in with other halachot that we see. But he claimed, because the Gemara doesn't ask from Mechamer, it shows or indicates there's no Mechamer on Yom Tov, despite the fact that those are asurim on Shabbat. And the Ramban says the same question could be asked by Shvi'it.
And why does the Gemara ask that? Because the Gemara knew for certain by Shvi'it there's Ein Chiluk Malachot. If you do multiple Malachot that are a violation of Shvi'it, then you only get one set of Malachot for that violation. The only question came up, as we see the Gemara is going to challenge here with regards to Yom Tov. So Amale Ada. So now here is a question as to what Ada means over here. And you can see on the side, Kamo Zotehe, this should be. So it's not a quote from a particular individual, but this is the way it should be. And you can see the Bach brings that down as well. Ada means this is the right way to think about it. Adate means this is the right way to say it. Although, in other places, individuals say that Ado was the name of a chacham. And Adate means Ada said something similar. And so he's saying that not only is that your view, but Ada says the same thing. So one of those two is the response that Rav Nachman's giving in this case. Either it is the fact that good logic or good point, or it's that Ada backs up what you're saying, and so there's another chacham with the same view that you have. Eitavei Abaye. Vein chiluk melachot b'yom tov. It's really true. There's no such thing as chiluk melachot b'yom tov. That's none. Don't we have a mishnah? And Michelle hit b'chalav b'yom tov v'achalo lukei chamesh. Someone who cooks a gidan asher in chalav, it's a gidan asher which is restricted, but he does it in chalav, it becomes basar b'chalav, you have to believe that a gidan asher is notein tam, that it has some flavor to it, and therefore it affects the chalav. B'yom tov, if you do this on yom tov and eat it, you're going to get five sets of malkot. Lokei mishum, this is what you're getting malkot for. Ochel gidan asher, which is a restriction. Number two is, lokei mishum b'vashel b'yom tov. Cooking on yom tov is also a violation. Shalo l'tzorech, which was not necessary because you can't eat it. You can only cook on Yom Tov when it's necessary. Over here, it's not necessary for you to cook it. Here, we know the machloket and the Gemara and Beitza between Rashi and the Balei Tosafot as to what type of tzorech you need. Rashi seems to say you don't need any tzorech at all, as the Balei Tosafot think you need a tzorech tzat. There has to be some relationship to Yom Tov. Over here, this is completely unnecessary on Yom Tov, and it's a cooking that has no bearing on Yom Tov whatsoever. There's no value or toilet to the cooking because you can't eat it. Although the Ritva claims that this is only according to Beit Shammai, says that only things that are for Tzorech Ochel Nefesh are permitted on Yom Tov, because Beit Hillel's Matir Shelo LeTzorech does still require, according to the Bayit Tosafot, Tzorech. Over here would say even though there's no Tzorech Yom Tov, it still will not result in Malkot. It'll just be an Isur because there's no Tzorech HaYom Tov at all because of the fact that you can't eat it on Yom Tov. Below Kemishum Evashel Gid Bechalav, get Malkot for cooking Basar Bechalav, which is a problem. Again, assuming that Gid HaNeshe is Notein Tam, it's classified as Basar, you have a problem of cooking Basar Bechalav. Below Kemishum Okel Basar Bechalav, and then you get Malkot for eating milk and meat together. And the fifth one is Below Kemishum Havara, for lighting a fire in order to cook. Bimita, if you are right, mishum havara lo mechayev. How could you make him chayev havara? Hayichayev le mishum bishulo. You already made him chayev on Yom Tov for cooking. You tell me there's no chiluk melachot on Yom Tov. How can you say there are five violations here, which include bishul on Yom Tov and havara on Yom Tov? Bishul and havara are all melachot Yom Tov, and there should be one violation then. So apik havara va'ayol bidanashe shel nevela. Add in another item here. Instead of saying that it was a problem of Havara, say it was a problem of Gidan Asher of Nevela. So there's an additional restriction of Nevela over here that you are violating. Vatane Rebbe Chia, Lokeshtaim Al-Chilato, Shalosh Abishulo. That two out of the five relate to eating, three out of the five relate to cooking. Now you've just flipped it, because you took out Havara, which is a cooking violation, and then you put in nevela, which becomes an eating violation, and there it's no longer two and three. It's going to be three eating and two of bishul. Bimita shlosh achilatohu chayav. You're making now that he's in violation of three for eating. Ella, apik havara, take havara out of that. V'ayo atzei ashera. It's a case where they put in avodah zarah, wood, to cook the item. Vazadrei mihacha, and he's in this violation of this. V'lo yidbak biyadcha mu'ma min acherim. You're not allowed to take anything from the spoils of the beauty. That means that you're not allowed to take anything that is associated with Avodah Zarah. You want to get involved in Avodah Zarah? Then you have another restriction. It's not just one law for Avodah Zarah. Not just lo yibak beyadchem u'ma min acherim, but also lo tavit to ibala beitefka. You've been in violation of two lavin. So that doesn't work so well. He uses wood that belonged to Hekdesh, they'll cook the item, and then he's in violation of Me'ilah, which is intentionally misappropriating items of Hekdesh, and that gets you a set of Malkot. And the warnings from here, Asherehem Tisrufunesh, the Asherah you must burn or get rid of, that of Avodah Zarah, Lotasun Kein, Lashem Lekechem, you may not do such to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. We already discussed over there the Psukim of whether the Lotasun Kein has to do with the Mizbeach, and that where you're makriv everywhere, don't do that to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Or is it connected to Asherehem, burning up or destroying the Avodah Zarah, don't do that to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And over here, they make that association, that juxtaposition, that what you do to Avodah Zarah, don't do to God. So here, where you're burning up Hekdesh, you're doing something that you would do to Avodah Zarah, to Kodesh Baruch Hu's property or to his Hekdesh. That is the fifth violation over here. And then it avoids the problem of the lack of Chiluk Malachot on Yom Tov, because now you're only Chayav for one violation on Yom Tov, which is Mevashel, because we took off Havara and replaced it with the problem of Me'ilah. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Chavet Amud Aleph.